Hi, welcome to Outrageous, our weekly podcast where we talk about culture, media, race, politics, and everything in between. Yet again, I'm joined by my two very best friends, Jason in Washington, D.C. Jason.
Good evening. I'm happy to be talking to you with my new mic headset.
Yeah, that sounds exciting. And Trisha from Los Angeles. Hi, Trisha.
Hi. It's rainy here and cold, actually.
It's rainy and cold here, too.
And here, too. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God. That must be different from... where were you? You were just in Fort Lauderdale or Miami, Trish?
Miami.
And how was that?
It was exciting.
It was a downscale Palm Springs, huh?
It was exciting. But, you know, it was muggy and it was hot and I wasn't having it at all. So I'm delighted to be back in California where it's a nice, chilly 50s, it seems to me. And doing this podcast from my home because I didn't go into work today. Just for you.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow. You didn't go to work.
That's my dream. I never go to work.
I worked from home.
You know what I think all the time? Remember when the Powerball was like $1 billion a couple of weeks ago in January? And
yes.
Would you really quit working?
Of course. Stop yourself. Immediately upon winning the Powerball, I'm letting you know, immediately upon winning anything that allows me to say
you
to work. Listen, there are tons of things to do all day. I've got tennis matches to watch, some traveling to do. I would probably be happily distracted for a good 3 years before I settle myself down, probably start a foundation, and there you go.
Oh my God, you want to start a nonprofit?
Not a nonprofit, a foundation.
Okay. No, I actually think that as well.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I would be a full-time philanthropist and activist,
yes.
I think.
Totally. I mean, that's such an interesting arena, and it's sad that it's only open to people who have money because they don't spend their money well at all in that arena.
I think I would be a full-time fat ass.
You know what?
Like, I would totally just lay around and then like and I'd be like
I agree.
But I would like want to be like secret millionaire. Like I'd work at Barnes & Noble's and I'd like talk to people and they'd be like, "Oh my God, I want to get my son into college," and then after knowing them for 3 weeks, I'll be like, "By the way, I'm a secret billionaire, and I'm going to pay for it."
You're like undercover boss.
I know. That would give me the biggest joy to just walk through fairy godmothering everyone I met. That would be amazing. No, because people are really...
Well, I mean, you're still doing the same thing we're doing, just a different approach.
Yeah, he wants to do it like it's a freaking talk show.
Yes, and then I'll have my cameras come in at like a pivotal as they're crying. I'll be like, there. And I'll be like, yeah, there, into the camera, there. Look over there.
I'm solving all your money problems right now.
But it's so exploitative, but at the end of the day, I'm like, well, these people get money. Undercover boss, I'm like, it's really exploitative, but... Hell, I mean, someone needs new braces for their kids and they get it. What are you going to do?
That'd be great. I love it. I love lotto dreams.
I know.
One of my favorite activities is just imagining myself and my life when I win the lottery, which means I need to play it more, but...
I know. Oh my gosh, that was my mom's thing. My mom always used to have lotto dreams and then be like, "You ever play?" She's like, "No." Why should that stop me from winning? And I was like, "Mom, do you know how the lotto works? Because it doesn't work like that."
Maybe we can get Bernie Sanders to adopt a policy that all Americans win the lottery.
Oh, my gosh. Jason,
sounds as fanciful as all of his policies.
Jason, it's so funny you should bring up Bernie Sanders, because let's launch right into our topics. Oh, my gosh. I love it. You guys are totally in the segue pocket. That was fantastic.
That was great.
So let's move from Bernie Sanders and crazy things Democrats say to what Trisha wants to talk about. Take it away, Trish.
Okay, so obviously Bernie Sanders is on an upswing right now, right? He's won the last two caucuses, and he's won the Wisconsin primary. After having, I think he had had, he was seriously behind Hillary for quite some time, like late last year in Wisconsin, and suddenly he snuck in, and I think he won 71 of 72 counties.
Wow.
This guy is, he's on an upswing. And then here comes this New York Daily News?
I can't remember if it was the Daily News or the Post. It's probably the Daily News.
No, it's the Daily News. It was the Daily News. So the New York Daily News editorial board sat down because I think they were contemplating endorsing Bernie Sanders. And so they wanted to ask him about sort of signature elements of his campaign. Key questions really around his, you know, his constant sort of refrain about breaking up big banks and everything is too big to fail. And so they proceeded to take him through a series of questions about how he would break up the banks, sort of what legal ground does he have to stand on. And it was the weirdest interview I'd ever encountered from a candidate. And I was surprised and kind of appalled by maybe his lack of preparation for it. Did you all get a chance to read that interview?
I read parts of it, yeah.
What were your impressions? I mean, you know, everyone was, of course, aghast. They're like, oh, my God. At some point in time, I think Bernie even said, I haven't thought that point through, which was like the big piece, the centerpiece, which is what it would look like to break up banks.
Like, what does what that actually mean?
What would happen to the employees?
I was actually not surprised. I'm really glad you brought this up because I wanted to talk about this with you too. This has echoes of the Trump interview with the Washington Post editorial board a couple of weeks ago, where something very similar happened, where he sat down for an hour and was unable to advance any coherent agenda or point of view, to the point where they asked him about they asked him about a possible ground war in the Middle East against ISIS. And he started off rambling and then ended up talking about Jeb Bush. And they were like, Jeb Bush is no longer in the race and we're asking policy questions, to which point he responded, hey, I don't think I met everyone around the table. Why don't we all go around and tell me what your names are? And so, I mean, your question, so what you're asking, Tricia, so what you're asking about Bernie, how did this happen, I'm really not surprised. Both Bernie and Trump are running on this rhetorical platform, which doesn't really have anything to do with reality. It sounds really great to say, oh, let's break up the banks, let's send everyone to college for free, or let's build a big wall, let's throw women into jail or stone them if they have abortions. Those are fun things, but when rubber hits the road, there's nothing there. My question to the two of you is, are you surprised? Because I was surprised by my complete lack of surprise here. This is where we are. These are reality show candidates. You know what I mean? These are reality show candidates. So, like, when I read that in the paper, I was like, oh, well, of course when you ask Bernie how he's going to do something, he doesn't have an answer. Of course he doesn't have an answer.
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, you could see these two candidates as the kind of natural outcome of the soundbite culture that's been getting more and more concise over time, the 140 character tweets. You know, we live in an age of communication where brevity, you know, trumps everything. And so you have these two candidates who put out tweets that sound great. Who doesn't want free college? Who doesn't want to make sure jobs come back to the United States? Who doesn't want to cut off the head of ISIS? But you know, do these folks have plans? Do they have any understanding of how they could do this? Would it ever be possible for them to do this? For the people who are following them, you know, it never gets to that level. And for folks like us, people who are more skeptical of them, who actually read interviews like this, I think that we if you just look back at the past 20 years in terms of mass communications, I actually think it's quite logical that now folks like this can get the, you know, the backing they have. What will be very interesting is if one of them actually wins an election, because then when they actually are in a position where they, you know, they've been elected to deliver on their promises, I continue to say, I wish we could make these folks president for like a day or a week. I wouldn't want them to be president for more than that, but I just want to see what they would do. Like, I'm just fascinated to know, like, what would Sanders actually do sitting in the Oval Office? What would Trump do? It's not totally unclear because there's nothing that they've said. You know, they say what they're going to deliver, but in terms of any sense of how that would ever be delivered, there's just no, there's nothing there.
I disagree. I do not want to see what they do. And this is again, the kind of reality show thinking. Oh, I'm voting for Trump just because I just want to see what will happen when he wins.
I didn't say I was voting for him. I did not.
I know. I'm just that kind of thinking, though, leads us there. And I've been hearing that a lot, both in private conversations and in public on TV. People are just like, oh, wouldn't it be interesting to see like what a Sanders presidency would look like for a month or a Trump for a month. Those are the same people who pose questions like, on a certain level, wouldn't nuclear war be kind of interesting? And I'm like, no, no, it wouldn't. It sounds like a shit show. I don't know. This is not
just
politics has become
just think
performative
about,
and it's disturbing to me.
Just think about a West Wing version of the Apprentice.
Look at
I
you.
I mean, it would just be
so,
you know, just seeing fire cabinet members.
Are you pitching to NBC? I'm not interested in seeing this show because it has real effects on my life.
Well, no, I mean, you know, because listen, I was struck by the interview, but I'm also not a particularly knowledgeable person about these kind of finer issues, you know, finer details about what's allowed by Congress, what's in the president's purview, all of that. So, I mean, I have to sort of take a little bit of trust in people's overreaction to Bernie's, you know, responses. But I think what struck me, though, is that I guess one of the things that I've been having a problem with is that it's not so much because I then went ahead and tried to find some research, and there is like a piece in Jacobin magazine, which is I think it's actually a very leftist magazine, and they wrote a response to Bernie's article, and it's called Bernie versus the Banks, and they basically kind of backed up Bernie by talking about sort of historically what his approach is, what his approach should be, and what he probably has mentioned in other places. But I think that that's what was surprising to me. What was surprising to me is that he didn't have a lot of specificity, given the fact that this was sort of the centerpiece of his campaign, and that he was being interviewed by a magazine based in New York, or a paper based in New York, where the campaign is shifting its attention and its focus. So, I mean, the lack of preparation was probably the most startling thing, and that the fact that in some ways I wasn't able to be educated more about it in the interview. That was my point. And I wanted that.
What's interesting, though...
You did?
Yeah, because listen, if that's a centerpiece, if the centerpiece of you... Listen, at some point in time, we're going to have to take Bernie seriously because on some level, Well, listen, his lead... you have to deal with the fact that there is a strong... we're trapped with these two candidates on the left. So you have to deal with the reality that Hillary Clinton is not a clean, clear-cut march towards that White House. It's just not. There's sexism involved in that. There's also the fact that she's not someone that gets people entirely enthusiastically rearing to go for her, and that Bernie is sort of seeing a little bit of a surge. So you have to begin to contemplate the possibility of Bernie, just like how people dismiss Trump and his possibility, and now that party is trying to figure out how the hell they're going to sort this out. I don't think we have to be as smug on the left either, and I'm not a leftist at all, but I do think that, you know, so this is his moment to sort of unveil a major part of his platform. And I was surprised by the holes. Or just his inability or his failure to sort of demonstrate how difficult he really thinks the work ahead would be.
It's at some points it appeared that he didn't know what his authority as president would be to accomplish the things that he's talking about, especially in the financial arena and breaking up banks and what that would look like. He had no idea, which doesn't inspire confidence. But I'm what's what I'm looking for? I am a little sort of surprised.
That I'm surprised?
Yeah. Like I feel like you've seen Bernie Sanders coming as far as who he is and what
he's doing. Oh, well, of course. Next. Well, yeah. I've seen him coming, but it doesn't mean that I didn't think that he was gonna try to prepare himself as best as possible. Listen, nobody
said preparation is not necessary for this election cycle. you know what I mean? But like that's where we are.
I guess so. I mean, I guess.
Look, we're in a new political arena. We're in a new political environment where Sarah Palin exists. Just the existence of Sarah Palin has signaled something to both sides, clearly, both the left and the right. I'm not going to credit Sarah Palin so much with creating Donald Trump, but she certainly did create an environment, her and the rest of the Tea Party, that whole movement has created an environment where we look down upon preparation, experience, in some ways, coherent attitudes and thoughts.
Yeah.
And we...
Governance, policy,
governance in general.
Politics.
And politics in general. So we have created a class of politicians who want nothing to do with politics and really want nothing to do with experience and... like thought out policies. This is a problem, right. But this is what we're stuck with. And when it was just the Tea Party and it was just Sarah Palin, then it was kind of like, well, in some ways, not really, but sort of cute in that it was like, oh, here's all these people who are all already so horribly out of touch in this country, and look how even more horribly out of touch they are trying to appeal to country bumpkins. The problem is, here comes Bernie Sanders, who is the exact same thing on the right.
On the left.
On the left. Whoops.
I feel like I haven't heard anything. I feel like I haven't heard much from you, Jason. What did you think?
Jason, solve all of our problems, please.
Yes, white savior.
Yes. Oh, thank God you're in the conversation.
Well, I don't. There are two things I'd want to say.
This better
one
be good.
One is, I don't think it's just a lack of preparation. It's the fact that his ideas are not executable. Like, a lot of his ideas, if they were executable, I might be drawn to, but they're not. So that's one. I don't think there's any way you could prepare for the fact that what he's saying cannot be done anytime soon. I do want to point out, and I know you two know this, but I feel compelled to point out that Trump, you know, in his interview, and it is interesting, there's certainly a comparison to be drawn here, but I mean, he alienated a significant potential sector that could be supporting him when he made the comment he did about punishing women who get abortions. I mean, that was a massive misstep. Whereas I think Sanders, first of all, is just less offensive, I think. But also, you know, they revealed the fact that I thought that, you know, these things, there's no game plan here. With Trump, I think it's even more, not just that there's not a game plan, but I think what you were just saying, Chris, there's not even a coherence of ideas. Like, it just, he floats from one thing to the next. Sanders is consistent. I mean,
yeah.
You know what he stands for. There's no way to get there, but what he stands for has been consistent. Trump is all over the place. And so in that way, I think it's important to distinguish them from Trump, who is a marketer, and that's what he's been his whole career, and that's all he is, versus Sanders, who really, I mean, he's a, you know, socialist Democrat. He wants these things. He doesn't have a way to get them, but he wants them. That's what he stands for.
And I also, to be honest, I just think we have to admit to the fact that Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat.
Yes.
He's not.
Yes.
He's not. So,
that's,
I mean,
true.
Yeah, and I just, I don't know. I don't know what my resistance to Bernie is. I want to like Bernie. I really do.
Why?
You know why? Because there's a part of... Because you know what? I see the people who are lining up for Bernie, and I can totally see why they would. You know, Muslims for Bernie, young people for Bernie. And so it's a real kind of a... I mean, listen, we're all friends here. Let's talk about this. This is one of those moments where I ask myself, have I gotten old? Am I too cynical? Do I mean, because, you know, many, many years ago, people would have said a $15 minimum wage is impossible. But what are you guys are having that in New York State soon. And it's happening in California. And I think we even have like, what, an $18 minimum wage in Oregon. So, or Seattle, someplace. So, you know, it's just, there are these things that seem impossible initially. And so, and we're moving slowly towards the space. So maybe there isn't any sort of impossibility to many of Bernie's things. And so I just want to make I just want to check my own cynicism. And of course, you know, and in light of that, then I found this wonderful article. It was like an opinion piece written, I think, in the Washington Post, and I shared it with my fellow gang about sort of Black Americans' pragmatism and why they haven't felt compelled by any of Bernie's arguments. And it made me feel good.
In what way?
Because I think what it did is it sort of really helped me to understand my own resistance to Bernie, which is that in some ways, if you've been paying attention for the last 8 years, Obama is not even like a leftist, okay? And so many of his policies are to the right of Bernie's, and the country could barely deal.
Absolutely.
Barely
no question.
Deal, you know? And so my own calculation is that if the punchy couldn't even deal with the things that President Obama was attempting to bring forth, what makes the rest of the left or the Democrats that are sort of rah-rahing behind Bernie convinced that this is going to be possible in this next cycle of presidency when we've had so much kind of resistance and sort of pushback from the right so much? How do they conceive of the possibility that we could go so far left then?
Well, it's the same thing with Trump, just flipped the other way. Both of those candidates are running on revolution of different sorts.
Yeah, so, I guess.
So it's not really branded. It's not, sorry. So it's not really grounded in anything practical. I am personally sick to death of talking about Bernie Sanders, and I'll tell you why. He is the Donald Trump of the left. I don't mean he's as a hateful bigot. What I mean is that he wants to rile people up to no end. I'm not certain that Bernie Sanders could be president. I'm not certain if he thinks he can be president. There's no coherence to what he's saying. I mean, there's consistency, like one of you said earlier. He's definitely consistent. But deep down, he's got to know he doesn't have a plan. And his people have got to know he doesn't have a plan. He doesn't have intentions on being president. I'm not certain what him, I'm not certain what he and Donald Trump are doing in this race. I really, other than to rile people up and get screen time for the next project they're going to be working on.
I don't know if I'm that cynical about Bernie. I do think that Bernie entered the campaign to realistically push Hillary Clinton to the left. I do really believe that. But I think
that's why he's here too. I don't think that
I think
he
that
plans
was where
president.
I think that's why he was here. I think he actually now believes. You listen, there's nothing as seductive as having a crowd of people rah-rahing and cheering you on and having you win some primaries for you to suddenly realize that, hey, maybe I'm not gonna be Ross Perot.
Maybe I'm actually Ross Perot.
Yeah, remember Ross Perot?
So cute.
with his charts and everything, you remember?
So cute.
So, you know, I think he's decided he doesn't want to be Ross Perot. I think he decided that he wants to be Obama, but, you know.
So, Jason, bridge the gap between us so we can move on. Trisha is trying to peek into the Bernie camp, very interested in what's going on there. I can't even deal with Bernie. I don't want to be anywhere near the Bernie camp. I'm not interested in the parties they're throwing. Where are you, Jason?
Well, I don't think he'll be president. I don't think he should be president. I do think the value he adds is I do think he is reminding the country that the Democratic Party is not so far to the left. Whether we like that or not, you know, people on the right who look at what Obama has done and, you know, like use the word socialist as like Newt Gingrich and others have. It's so absurd. And it's only in a country like this where one could say that. I think what Bernie brings is like a reminder that like, I mean, he is helping, I think, America see Hillary as the centrist that she is, which may make her more palatable to a wider audience.
All right. So we will leave that there. I feel like, Jason, you did not talk that much during the last one, so I'm going to let you just jump right into your topic right now.
Okay. So Princeton University, one of its esteemed presidents, I guess its most esteemed president, was Woodrow Wilson, who, of course, later went on to be president of the United States. And their school public policy is named after him because he was the president of Princeton, and of course he was very decorated as president in terms of starting the League of Nations and, you know, World War One and that kind of thing. But Woodrow Wilson, and this is well documented, I don't think there's any debate about it, was a segregationist. When he became president, he resegregated things like the federal government that were not previously segregated or that had already been integrated. He was friends with the author of the book, that Birth of a Nation, that awful KKK propagandist movie was based on, and he was friends with the director of the movie as well. He hosted a private screening of the movie at the White House, which is a movie that shows white men in blackface playing villainous black men and the KKK being the heroic movement that was to combat these black men who were terrorizing white women. So this guy, I mean, I'm not saying he didn't do some good things. He did. But I would guess that for African-Americans, it would be extremely uncomfortable and feel like you are not welcome and that you're not in an inclusive environment to have this person's name prominently on this school at Princeton. And there was an activist group that did a sit-in to actually push the university to consider changing the name of the school. The university did agree to consider it. They took a long time considering it, and they've decided ultimately to keep the name but change the way they talk about him. Now where there is some progress is they are now very publicly on campus and throughout the country talking about the complexity of Wilson, including some of the really ugly and heinous things about him. That said, I think it's inexcusable that they continue to name the school after him, and the idea that they are committed to diversity and inclusion, and I'm not saying in their heads they're not, but to think that, you know, that there's a commitment to diversity and inclusion when you have this staunch segregationist who had a major negative impact on African Americans, your school is named after them, is named after him. I just feel like there's a huge hypocrisy there.
I think about this often because I want to agree with you. When this past summer there was a lot of attention on the Confederate flag being flown at the state buildings of southern states, and that one black woman heroically climbed the flagpole and tore it down and then was arrested. It was really great.
Yep.
I understand the power of symbols. I understand why that particular symbol is really painful. So I'm on your side there. Then I'm sort of like, this country was founded in bigotry and race hatred and slavery and the rest of it. Like, that's the blood of which America boiled out of. Are we going to go around changing the names of all these institutions? Because I'll tell you, almost every president, like presidents up until recently within my lifetime, have been pretty avowed racists. Are we going to start renaming all this stuff? That's my question back to you. So I understand what you're saying. I understand definitely. And I definitely, when you were down south and you were driving down like Robert E. Lee Highway, there's definitely something that clicks in my mind like, oh, damn. How far do we go with this? Just universities or street signs or whatever? The names of squares. You know, I live near a Christopher Columbus Square. That could be triggering for people. Should we change the name of Christopher Columbus Square?
So let me be clear. Princeton University, like many, quote, elite, unquote, universities, I think genuinely want to have more diverse campuses. I think for lots of reasons, it's an embarrassment. You know, I went to University of Pennsylvania, Ivy League school like Princeton, you know, rival schools. And when I was there, I mean, it was embarrassing. What a small percentage of African American students there were, and I think it was not a welcoming environment. So Princeton is saying, like, we're going to keep his name up, but we also want to really increase the number of African Americans and people of color we want at our school, and we want to have a culture of inclusion. And I'm saying looking at it from their eyes, those two things, if I were them or if I were advising them, I would say, change the name of the school. Do we have to change everything? I don't think we have to. I think it's a conversation worth having. But if you have a certain mission or objective, and yet you're choosing to maintain what they're maintaining, I think it's kind of absurd. It sounds like a joke to me. We want more black people. We're going to keep the Wilson name. Come apply to us, black people.
Trisha?
First of all, I'm not that familiar with Wilson's history. And I assume that if we became familiar with all of the histories, a lot of names would have to be changed. So I don't know. I don't know where I fall on it. Because I think on one level, I really believe in the idea. I mean, it's been happening a lot. I've seen a lot of pushback on building names and things like that. I don't really know if I care so much about the building name if you're going to be able to use that to shift your policy in an active way. Because, and I really get your point, Jason, about the hypocrisy of it all. But I don't mind if your hypocrisy leads you, or if I don't mind if you're sort of like in kind of the pushback for history, that you then have to embrace policies that's antithetical to the thing that is over the head of your building. So because you've now sort of uncovered this history, or this history has been made plain and clear, and it's on an educational institution, you can then say, but you know what, we are working to move away from the place that we started. This was the historical grounding of where we are, and this is how far we have come, and this is why we're going to adopt these policies. I feel somewhat comfortable with that move, because I feel like we're going to have to deal with that move quite a bit in America.
So I want to explore where the line is here. Just humor me for a second. Suppose you, Trisha, get a traffic violation and you have to go to the courthouse. So you get onto the courthouse, and as you approach, you realize that the courthouse is called the David Duke Hall of Justice.
Yeah.
Now,
did he pay a lot of money for that hall?
Yeah, so walking in, how do you feel about your chances of really being heard at the David Duke Hall of Justice? Does that matter to you that that's where it is?
I mean, that's a difficult situation. I mean, I think it's the wrong framing, because what you're talking about is an educational institution.
I know it's the wrong framing. I'm just exploring where the boundaries are here.
There are no boundaries. I mean, I think, listen, everything is hypocritical. That's the point. The point is, like, the history is written. I mean, this is the thing, though. I mean, we can't rest there. But listen, history is written by the winners. And winners get to name buildings after themselves. And then you get to push.
But Jason's question is, do we have to accept that?
I don't care about the naming of the building. I care about your policy after. You know, just because something is all white or all black or, you know what I mean? We can't always just go by labels, because I've been in places where you would think that you'd feel 100% comfortable because it's named after some African, right? And it's like, and then the way things are executed are poor. So I just want us to move beyond that, though.
I guess. I know that when I'm walking down Malcolm X Boulevard, I'm like, oh, yeah.
No, you're not.
I'm not. I'm never over there.
I mean, we've all discussed the ultimate irony of, like, places that are named after really amazing, wonderful people. MLK Boulevard is like a place you don't want to be at night in certain neighborhoods. And it's sad.
Dr. King has so many projects named after him.
No, it's horrendous. So the naming of a thing is very important. I will never deny that. But I'm always much more interested in your policy initiative and whether this pushback from students will make you even more sensitive and cause to move even in another direction where you're like, I'm going to move away from the history that we have. Maybe they're choosing to keep it because a funder has said no. You have no idea why they're saying no. Most institutions, listen, these are money-making businesses. So maybe the people who support that institution, aside from students who go into tremendous debt to pay for it, maybe there's a tremendous trustee who has a lot of cash.
But that doesn't make
Princeton.
It right. Like, okay, so now
but
I'm advancing.
We're not speaking about right or wrong.
I'm advancing what Jason, you could totally talk for yourself. But again, I want to explore where our boundaries are with this, because on one level, I absolutely understand what you're saying, Jason. On the other level, I think there is a line which would make each of us uncomfortable. You know what I'm saying? Like,
we're not going to name it after Hitler.
Well, I don't know, but it doesn't have to be Hitler. But like, Jason, when your wife was pregnant and delivering your kids, would you have gone to like the Mengele Hospital if that was the name of it? You wouldn't. You just wouldn't. Like, there's something about that.
Well, listen, and, but you guys,
and like you said, names have power. Now, I understand what you're saying, Tricia, in that you are far more concerned about the policies and stuff that goes on in there. And Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like what's underpinning Jason's question is that in the decision to keep a name really like that, can they really advance the policies that you're looking for, Tricia? If the David Duke Hall of Justice called the David Duke Hall of Justice and that decision made, then that means that, like, you may not find a whole bunch of justice in there because the people who decided to keep that name can't really advance the policies that you'd be interested in.
No, because I really believe in cutting in separating what people choose to do from what is practically going to happen. So, like, you know, it's like when people come out and they've said something horrendous and then they publicly apologize,
mm-hmm.
and then they silence themselves, go away, but nothing has changed about it. So for me, it's like, does this generate a space where we get to be conscious of who Woodrow Wilson is? Do we get to sort of be cognizant of the kind of complexity of his history, because he was a winner for a lot of Americans, but not for African Americans, but he was a winner for the country in their minds. And so I have a problem with erasure. I really do.
I agree.
I'm not saying one is over the other.
I want to respond to that, though, because I feel like this comes up. I hear this all the time. There's like this debate nearby in Maryland about, mm-hmm. there's some like circle or square, I forget which shape, but that's like named after a Confederate person. And there's this debate and people are like, well, we don't want to erase it. And like, I got to say, I do not find that argument compelling. I am not saying to erase Woodrow Wilson, put a plaque on the wall, teach about him, have courses on him. I am not talking about erasure, but I am talking about if Princeton University is saying, and this is what they're saying, we're going to have a new commitment to diversity and inclusion. You know, I mean, I believe branding is important. Like, I think what you call it is important. And, you know, Tricia, you're saying the building, but, you know, universities like Princeton, it's not a name gets transported all over the country. Conferences, who are you? I'm the professor. You know, I'm a professor at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy. Oh, what was Woodrow Wilson's first public policy when he was president? Oh, it was to resegregate the federal government. Wow, that's an interesting public policy stance that you are, you know, championing in the name of your school.
You took it too far, Jason. No. Or you say,
He took it too far.
No,
but go ahead.
Take it too far, because see, this is what I want. I want us to admit the truth of it. I think it's perfectly okay for you to say, yeah, that was one of his major policy initiatives, and you know what, it's really we're really happy as a university that we've been able to push back at that history by making sure that we have scholarships for students who want to come here, that we graduate all of the minority students that attend here. I mean, you could, there's a space for that. There's a space.
Why can't you do both? Why can't you do both?
Well, because you don't.
Why would you? Why would you?
You don't.
Yeah,
because as soon as you take it away, you don't have to talk about it again. It's like,
I disagree with that. I don't think that's
Band-aid.
True.
It's a Band-aid.
No, I'm afraid I've now swung to Trisha's side. You know what, Jason? I see what she's saying in the sense like let's talk about Christopher Columbus, because we talk about that a lot in public spaces, right? So Christopher Columbus Day. If you live in a humongous city like New York with liberals falling out of every window, you know it as Indigenous Peoples Day. And the idea is that, you know, Christopher Columbus was such a monster, we shouldn't celebrate him. However, keeping it called Christopher Columbus Day, the fact that there is a statue of Christopher Columbus in Christopher Columbus Square near my house keeps a conversation going exactly about who Christopher Columbus was. So every time I get off the bus at Christopher Columbus Square, I look up and I go, man, that guy was a monster. And I move on with my day. You know, and that's the corrective. Renaming it like, you know, the Chris Columbus director of Harry Potter Square, that's not going to help anything, really, is it?
But especially
I disagree. I mean, we
like to erase. We like to pretend. I understand your point, though, Jason. I do. But what happens in America is that America likes to solve a problem and put it away. It just does. That's what it does. It likes to, like,
We talk about foreign bigots all the time, like Stalin, Hitler. Like, It's not like we don't talk about these people. Like you're saying, like, oh, we never talk about them. We do talk about them.
But they're not ours. There's no ownership there, so we can talk about them. Americans love to talk about foreign villains. They're the best because they're completely disconnected from America. But when it comes to talking about American villainy, we don't like to do it. So in a weird way, you take it's just like, I think if you can, you have to constantly confront the very thing that is in your face. And every time you mention Woodrow Wilson, it's going to come up. It's like Woodrow Wilson. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like you can't gloss it over anymore. Now that the students have done it, and now that they've chosen not to rename it, it's like it becomes like a story about that university that the university on some level has to live down in its practice.
I think going forward, they certainly can avoid picking controversial people. You know, like the Megyn Kelly Women's Studies program or something. Or
although you can't, because do you see how Megyn Kelly's being reframed as a heroine now? This is the thing.
That happens every 2 years. Every 2 years, they want to think about Megyn Kelly differently, and then she gets on air and looks into the camera and says, "Don't worry, children, Santa's white." And then everyone's like, "Whoa, take her off the cover of things." You know what I mean? So that's not surprising. But my point being is that we can choose not to name things after, you know, yes, present-day villains like Ann Coulter and whoever. We can choose not to use those people. But, you know, Jason, I think I'm kind of vibing with what Trisha is saying. We don't want to erase these things. We don't want to brick over and build over parts of our history. We don't want to cherry-pick what's going on, how this country got to be where it was. The fact that buildings were named after Woodrow Wilson, the fact that buildings and things are named after Teddy Roosevelt, which, if you're not familiar with his history, please look into it. It's interesting.
Andrew Jackson. I mean, the Native Americans should be, like, wincing at the thought of anything that has him on it.
In front of the Museum of Natural History here in New York, there's a statue of Teddy Roosevelt astride a horse being led by two Native Americans as if he's saving the entire world. I mean, the fact that that exists, it opens a conversation. Should we take that down because of who Teddy Roosevelt was? No, because that is the legacy that we all should remember. We have to remember that this country was built by men like that, because that will remind us where we can't go back to.
Exactly.
When we take those things away, and you will get like the Ann Coulter School of Economics, because we will quickly have forgotten what villainy looks like.
I just think we have to keep reminders. I think we just got to do it.
Jason, where are you at? Do you still vehemently disagree with us?
He can't,
are you shaking
though.
Your fist at us?
He can't vehemently disagree because you know what? Because he knows on some level though, there's validity to his claim. It's true. I mean, I totally see Jason.
Don't talk
point.
For him though. He's right here.
I do, but he's not talking.
No. Are you mad at us, Jason? God damn it.
He is.
I disagree with you guys. I think we could rename things and still find ways to make sure we still talk about things. You know, I was fortunate enough to go to the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union, and then go back many years later. And many cities have been renamed, squares have been renamed. Lenin's tomb is still in Red Square. Now, when I went, when it was the Soviet Union, you couldn't take pictures there. You were very quiet. It was like they demanded respect. When I went back, however many years later, 15 years later, there were people in Lenin and Marx costumes. And so, you know, I disagree that, you know, changing these names, you erase it or you fall back into these frames of mind or allowing certain things to happen. I think you can do both. And I guess I would just like to end by saying my strong recommendation to people who consider applying to the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy, people who consider giving money to it, is I think they shouldn't, because I think there are schools of public policy, and yes, everyone's a complicated figure. If I were applying to public policy school, I'd apply to schools that had names on them that I'm sure would still be complicated, but, you know, had public policy stances that weren't so incredibly oppressive to a subjugated group of people.
So, although, can I just rebut that by saying that you should apply to a school that actually lives its policies, not just the name? Because I can take on a name and do the same damn thing. You just have to explore the school. No, but he said the same. Yeah, but you don't know that, though. That's the thing I'm saying. It's like, yes, you're only judging the school based on its decision to hold the name. You haven't said anything about what the institution is doing. That doesn't make sense to me.
I am going to move us on, actually, because this is a great segue into my topic, which is going to be a continuation of Jason's topic.
It is, actually.
So this may be old news, but I've been following this story for about a year, and it concerns trigger warnings at college campuses. There is this idea that it happened in Columbia last year, and ever since then I've been amazed and appalled. But I think in a class where they were teaching either Ovid or the Greek and Roman myths, that students became upset because there's a lot of sexual assault and rape in those stories, because that's what Zeus was doing to all those women in those stories. And the idea was that there needed to be trigger warnings before the classes were taught in the syllabus, and that required readings that had this sort of material in it should be made optional by the teacher, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Students should be given the option to miss class on days where those are discussed, and so on. Now, I am stunned by this, because this is an academic institution that these things are occurring at. And I find it confusing that in an academic institution that we want to stop people from receiving information because they personally find it troubling to them. I understand that we want to include other points of view, and especially we have a really bad track history in this country of telling alternate points of view. It's pretty much white men all the time. I think there's been this swing to want to like talk about other points of view and stop academia from espousing racist or super patriarchal misogynistic stuff. But I feel like it's swung the other way now, to where we want to coddle every single student, infantilize them in this way because they are special snowflakes and we can't have them bruised by alternate points of view. So, you know, there was an article in The Atlantic last year I was just reading, and it started off by talking about in a law school where some students approached the professor and asked him not to teach rape law because it might be triggering to people in the class. Now, that's ridiculous. And where does that lead us? Where does that lead us to have like a whole class of people who don't know how to prosecute rapists because in class some people might have been offended? I mean, explain that to the victims of the rape when the rapists get off because there's no DAs.
No one to prosecute.
And all the DAs are like, we didn't talk about it in class. We were afraid of hurting people's feelings. So what do you guys think about trigger warnings in academia? Does this make sense, or it doesn't make sense to you?
First of all, admittedly, I feel like such an old person because this trigger warning and some of the terms used were not in vogue when I was in college.
Where's your cane, Grandpa? Yeah. When you're age, Jason. Trigger warnings are the new rage.
But there's a difference between a trigger warning and we're not going to teach certain things. And I feel like people are victims of trauma. I had some trauma in my childhood. Many of us have. And, a professor bringing up a topic sensitively in the understanding that some people in the class may have suffered some trauma that this might trigger, like that, I think, it's good for keep that in mind, to be sensitive in how they present material. It's another thing to say we're not going to present the material. Like, that's just totally different. And, I mean, saying we're about to read something that's really violent, I think that's good. We should be sensitive to that. But the idea that we're not going to talk about certain things because it might upset you. And just as I was saying in the first segment that Sanders and Trump are the kind of natural progression of our soundbite tweet culture. I think, this is very much that every kid gets a trophy. God forbid a kid feel like they can't do anything in the world. You know, we have data that shows that while American kids are way behind in the aggregate, the rest of the industrialized world in academic skills, they are number one in confidence. That's a fact. Like when they give surveys in terms of whether they think they can do well at math, American kids all think they can do well at math. And I think it's just, this is now kids get into college, they have a voice, And it's like, oh my God, don't ever upset me. And it's not serving them well. It's not serving our country well. I think it's absurd.
Okay. Tricia, before you respond, I just want to re-clarify what my question is and exactly what I'm talking about. I'm not – so part of what I'm saying is what you're saying, Jason, is trigger warning, yes, is, you know, today in class we're going to be talking about violent rape. I just want to let everyone know ahead of time. I'm talking about something a little more extreme than that that's happening in college campuses and society, wherein that no one – people on an individual basis do not want to be discomforted at all. And I want to just fire off – three quick examples. One, last Halloween, I remember a lot of things on Facebook about be careful how you pick your costumes. You don't want to pretend to be pregnant because that could upset people who are having fertility issues. So you should avoid pregnancy costumes.
Oh, my God.
There was, bringing back up the rape law thing that I said, part of those students' complaint to the professor was also they didn't want him to use the word violate, as in there was a violation. You know, they because the word violate reminded could remind certain people about any sexual trauma they had. And the last case, the famous case, and this is outside of academia, but you may remember around the turn of the century, there was a I want to say this happened in D.C. There was an aide who used, I think he was either the comptroller, he had something to do with money, and he was explaining that he would use the city's money very frugally.
Niggardly.
Yes.
No, niggardly.
Very frugally, but the word that he chose to use was niggardly, which that's what it means. people, it means frugally. And we thought, people were so incensed and so offended by this that the man had to resign his job. Now, when you look up the roots of the word niggardly, it has nothing to do with the color black. It has nothing to do with African Americans or Africa. I think it had some Northern European root, right, from some other non-Romance language. So this is what I'm talking about, and Trisha, I want you to respond, is that it's this kind of hypersensitivity that I'm worried about in academia specifically, but also just in society. How can we discuss things? How can we introduce alternate points of view without everyone crying and hiding underneath a skirt?
So, I mean, I have a problem. This is I've been seeing a lot about trigger warnings for a while because I do read quite a bit about sort of rape trauma stories, I guess. You know, of course, I'm Jamaican, so everything has to be understood within the context of that, which is that Jamaicans are traditionally not very tactful. So we are not afraid of
that
words.
Was the most tactful way to say that about Jamaicans.
You know, we're not afraid of words. I mean, someone will tell you you're fat, and it's considered a compliment.
Are you kidding me?
Sometimes.
You have an Aunt Fatty. We all do. Yeah. All Jamaicans have an Aunt Fatty.
So this idea of kind of nurture. My biggest problem with this, the triggering is issue is in academia. Because, I mean, and I had a problem with it when we couldn't talk about slavery in high school as well, because that was supposedly going to make a lot of the African-American students like us be really upset. And I was like, I'm not in slavery right now. It happened. We should probably talk about it. I'm going to be okay if you mention the word slavery. So for me, though, I really believe that the whole point of being in an academic environment is to make yourself – It's to enter spaces that are uncomfortable. Maybe academicians don't know how to talk about complex topics anymore, and that's why they've had to go here. Maybe.
But why would you push this back on the academicians? Is that a word? Why would you put this back on the academics?
Well, but you know why? Because you're
clearly not coming from them.
No. Because it came out of an environment. It came out of an environment maybe of professors who took a certain approach in the classroom and a kind of lack of awareness that they were always teaching from a point of view. And I think maybe what happened was the lack of inclusivity in the early 90s led to this space. Because this is not a new thing. This is like there's a journey here. It's a journey where we used to think about certain things as canon. And then when anybody introduced an alternate point of view, a lot of those folks push back on it because they had a white male canon. And so I do think that this is sort of like the natural extension of this topic where people now don't feel like they can actually just sort of teach what they normally would teach. But I do think it came out of an interest in actually having a multiplicity of point of views reflected in the classroom. I agree with that. Multiplicity of point of view made people uncomfortable, and I think that's been the pushback.
I agree with the very last part of what you said and nothing before it. I'm not quick to blame the academics for this environment that was created. I think you referenced the early 90s, and I think what was happening in the 80s and the early 90s was the rise of political correctness, and that was a movement to correct the kind of narrative that had been endemic to American education and college campuses and other spaces. In other words, they were trying to let in other points of view. And that was very much about histories. It was very much about identities. It's very much about, I mean, this was the age of Ebonics and the rest of that. What's happening here, I'm signaling, and they mention this, they talk about this split in the Atlantic too. What's happening now is different, because now it's about your own subjective feelings of being traumatized or possibly being traumatized. So on one hand, I would say that this is a response vaguely to what might have been the situation in colleges, but I think the actual response to that was the political correctness movement 25 years ago. What's happening today is just sort of a response to, I hate to bring this up because they're easy punching bags, but millennials have a particular way of interfacing with the world. And that way is that my personal feelings, my subjective feelings trump. And not only do they trump, but if I could possibly feel this way, other people may feel that way, and therefore the environment should change to suit those other people, and by extension, me. That's really different from the political correctness movement. Because the first one was about education. The second one is about protection. I don't want to be exposed to alternate points of view, as opposed to what was happening in the 90s, which is like, there are alternate points of view, and here they are.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, I think, Tricia, you make really good points about, you know, there's always going to be an enormous amount of tension when thinking about academia and universities, because, you know, you have people coming from a certain age teaching people, in most cases, of a significantly younger age. And you have, you know, the university's job, part of its job, is to prepare its students for the world as it is, and to prepare them to make the world better. And so there's always going to be tension there. And I'm sure there are a ton of professors out there that are still teaching from a very unconscious white privilege point of view, and there are lots of professors, I think, you know, of all races that are probably much more conscious. I think that the thing is, though, for the reaction to be, don't talk about that stuff because I might be traumatized, that doesn't serve anyone well. If your concern is that whoever's teaching is teaching a very, you know, white privileged point of view, then the best thing to do is have them teach it and then respond and have activism and have, you know, like I think what you're referencing in the 80s and 90s, you know, the multiculturalism movement and things like that. But to say, you know, it just don't say that stuff because I might get upset. You're not being, and the other piece of this is the university is supposed to be preparing its students for the world. The world is not, you know, like most workplaces are not going to go out of their way to not offend you. And so you're going to walk into professional life and be unable to cope if you can't deal with things that, you know, are sexist or racist or white supremacist or heterosexist.
Even just discomforting. Could you imagine me going to work and my boss is like, hey, Chris, you know what? You show up to work late every day. I'm going to really need you to get it together. And my response is, actually, your use of the phrase get it together reminds me of when my father got drunk and my sister. So I'm really upset right now and I'm going to have to take a 20-minute coffee break. Could you imagine that? You're
right.
Fired.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's exactly the kind of thing that people feel entitled to do. And I don't know where it came from. I mean, I suspect I know where it came from. But I really do think it's this turn of the century anti-bullying, helicopter parenting. My kid is the center of the universe, not just mine, but yours as well. And I think these kids are growing up and they're taking it to college and they want to know why every single subject that they're learning doesn't appeal to them on a psychological level.
I think that when people say they're traumatized by things or they are being triggered, I think that they are trying to enter a space that we have not properly prepared them for, and that's the term they're using. And I do really see it as a sort of natural trend that's happened in institutions, because when people talk about the idea that institutions are becoming less diverse and they're less free, the reality was that that's what conservatives said about institutions in the 80s and the 90s, because they felt like they couldn't just say what they wanted to say anymore. And so I do think all of it is related, and I think that this kind of a pushback now that we're getting, where it seems like it's gone to some extreme, I don't know if I want to dismiss it and say that these people are crybabies. I think what it is that we never really crafted a space for people to understand multiplicity of points of view. I think that that's what's going on. And so because people have not been reared within that tradition, they then dismiss it as like, you know, this is my opinion and, you know, I just want to hold it and I don't want to have it challenged at all and blah, blah, blah. But I feel like it comes out of an intellectual tradition that was allowed to foster in academia.
I agree with that, Tricia. I think what I feel very critical of is the response. Like, I agree that in part it's, you know, I'm remembering taking art history in college, and there's, you know, there's a painting, The Rape of Europa, and the professor, who was a woman and was fantastic, said that, you know, she, in our textbook, the writer said that she was panting with anticipation just before she was raped, and the professor was saying, like, this is, you know, absurd, and, you know, no one, you know, like, she brought a much more, I think, logical and feminist, although it shouldn't require feminism to say that, like, a much more sensitive, so, like, I think there's truth to what you're saying, but for the response to be, don't say those things, or warn me every time you're about to, it's a counterproductive response.
And the only reason why it's possible is because it's a paid, you're paying for that experience.
That's
true.
Yeah, you're right about that.
Do you know what I mean? Because if this was a public institution where you weren't paying cash for it, then you wouldn't feel like you were empowered to even push back like that. But, you know, it's because sort of...
Oh, I disagree. I feel like people push back in public spaces. I feel like people push back in society all the time. I mean, we've been talking about academia, and I don't actually disagree with what you're saying. You're right.
It swims here.
Yes, absolutely. And I think people do this in the public space constantly. I had sent around this article that I was so confounded by. There was a picture of a Gap ad of these four girls just sort of, two were casually doing like some gymnast pose and the other two were just like chilling out. And they had to pull the ad because people said it was racist because one of the girls is like casually resting her arm on her sister's head and her sister happens to be black. And people read that as sort of an entire... whatever.
Genre.
Yeah, it was an entire comment of white supremacy and how this white girl is so comfortable resting her, you know, in much the same way that my brother rested his arm on my head almost my entire life. The fact is that people are constantly reading this into spaces, like not beyond academia, which brings me to what Jason's saying, is that if college is supposed to prepare you for the real world, they're releasing people into the real world who feel completely entitled to challenge anyone at any time and say to them, you're being offensive. Yeah. Not what you're saying is being offensive, and here's my rebuttal to it. You're being offensive, and I need you to stop right now.
Right.
And that's a problem. That's a problem.
Right.
Well, I mean,
Where does that go? Where does that end up?
Well, I mean, I think what you want is, I mean, this sort of leads back to our initial conversation where we were talking about the public space and what people feel free to say in the space and how we've kind of had like an anti-intellectual push. I think, I mean, because I did see the whole frothing about the Gap ad and I looked at the picture and I was like, okay. But the reality is that especially within a consumer space, if people say that they're offended by something, you don't actually have to defend it, because all you have to say is, I'm not going to pay for it, and the advertisers will swiftly do what they need to do. So that's so a market, true. Right?
That's true. Yeah, no, it's absolutely true.
It's a marketplace of ideas and consumption, which is why I don't have as much problem in that space, because that space is working around cash. So if someone's offended by something, they don't have a reason. They don't have to tell you.
Well, to your point, though, so is academia, isn't it?
No. But see, in academia, academic institutions traditionally had a mission, right? They had a mission that said that they were there to expand your mind and all of that BS. But see, what happens now is that all that BS. But you see, what happens is now that people are, I mean, think about this. Now that people are paying a tremendous amount of money to go to these educational spaces,
they want to tailor their experience. Yeah,
and it's their experience now, so they have a right to tell you what kind of experience they want to be having in the classroom, because they're paying you for that. Oh, you know what I mean?
What a
Which
mess.
Is really
no, that's right.
Sad.
That's right.
But that's mess. What it is, because it's become a consumption space. If it was a public space, if it was really truly public education, right? The idea is that you're trying to create citizens, and citizens will have to deal with being uncomfortable. I mean, this is kind of all related to the fact that I remember someone saying that, you know, one of the things that Barack Obama couldn't tell the American public was that they were going to have to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because this isn't just a millennial issue. Americans don't want to be uncomfortable, period.
Yeah.
So you actually couldn't ever.
Right, that's true. But back to Bernie Sanders, free college for everyone, and then maybe people won't feel so entitled.
Well, in a free institution, like in a free space, the onus on the teacher really changes, doesn't it? Right? You can say, listen, I have a responsibility to you to make sure that you are prepared for being a citizen.
Yeah.
And being a citizen means that you're going to have to take in certain complex ideas, right? And some of them are going to make you uncomfortable. And I know, because you're paying $30,000 for this, you don't want to be triggered, so I might have to change my policies. You know what I mean? I mean, this is, I think that's why, I think that's why
it's true.
So
ended
ridiculous.
Up that space. Because if you find out that Princeton is that place where you're always going to be triggered, there goes that, there goes the enrollment.
Then they have to be catering and carefully diapering all their students.
Yeah, I think in some ways I totally get your point, but you know, this is what happens when you've put yourself on in a marketplace. In a marketplace, you have to consider your clients' feelings.
I want to disagree with that, but we're like out of time for this segment. But
I know, right?
Leave you with that.
I know, triggering is so triggering.
I'm triggered. So let's move into recommendations. If you had a media event that you think that other people should see, read, hear, or experience, this is the time to talk about it. I am going to start. I have been watching this show. Don't ask me what network it's on. It's a British show called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. It made everyone's best of lists last year, and I figured I would check it out. It's a 7-episode miniseries, and it's about these it's set in 19th century England. And this man named Mr. Norrell decides he wants to bring practical magic back to England.
Oh, I heard about this.
He wants to make it respectable, and he takes in an apprentice named Jonathan Strange, and they have different ideas about how magic should be used. It sounds really fanciful and Harry Potter, but it's actually quite well done. The acting's really good, and I find myself being drawn more and more into the story. I'm halfway done, and it's really enjoyable, and I think people should check it out. If you like fantasy and drama, it's there. So that's my recommendation. See it. Oh, I also do want to say that I saw Batman vs. Superman.
Oh, yeah. How was that?
It's not my recommendation. Anyone else want to go?
Well, that could be a segue. I know you don't like when I do this, but I'm going to do an anti-recommendation.
Oh, no, I love it.
Jason.
Tell us.
I went to see the sequel to My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and
I have questions.
I didn't
the first
know
being why.
The first movie I really liked, and I didn't know this. It's the highest grossing romantic comedy of all time. I didn't know that, but
yeah.
The second one was just awful.
I'm
I mean, there
sure
were a couple
was.
Of funny parts, but
not have been.
I don't. I just don't know. It's the whole same cast.
Yeah.
Same writer. And like, I don't know how you could have taken so much from the first one and made such a bad sequel. It's like almost impressive that it was as bad as it was.
Oh no. Well, that's exactly my review of Batman vs Superman, actually. It's impressive. The way they were unable to make money on this idea or to continue to make money because it's going to be out of theaters in like 2 weeks. It's astounding how you can go wrong. But Trisha, you have a recommendation or an anti-recommendation?
No, I have a recommendation. I think this is a recommendation I made years back. But no. So I've been getting into listening to books.
Oh, I'm sorry. Welcome to 1998.
Yeah, exactly.
I know, right?
Are you getting them on CD or cassette?
I love when I go to the library and get all my favorite books on cassette. You, Trisha?
I'm listening to them on
Remember
my
when
phone.
You endorsed the radio last week? What is going on with you?
I've been listening to the radio.
I know. I'm listening to Audible. I've downloaded a couple books from Audible because they had like a 3 month kind of free subscription thing. So I downloaded this book called The Warmth of Other Suns, mm-hmm. and it's by Isabel Wilkerson. And this book is so bloody good. It is so good. Every now and then, I will pause and think about a character in the book, and it's maddening, and it's just really, it's wonderful. So this book, it's history. And so what she does is she follows, I believe it is 4 families that make the trek from the south to the north or to California. And so what's really great about the book, and I don't know if you all experience this, but you know, in high school, you only stop history, you know, history class stops after the Civil War. I don't know if you guys have like spent all of your time doing the Revolutionary War, especially American history stops after the stops at the Civil War.
European history stops after World War II.
Yeah, and so it's really funny. You barely get anything about World War I, and you certainly don't get anything about the Civil Rights era, and you certainly don't get anything about anything that happened in the 1900s. It's just all missing. So what's really great about Warmth of Other Suns is that it's a really great introduction to Black American history from the segregated South. And it's fantastic because the person who reads it gives great character to each person's story. And, you know, she follows all the characters up until they die, and some of them live to be like 100 and stuff. So it's just, it's really incredible. It's an incredible.
Wow, it sounds great.
It's really good. I can't say enough about it. And it really explains a lot of kind of African American ideas because I'm not born here, and so I know a lot of Caribbean history. But I think that's the first book that really kind of helped me to understand African Americans in a way that no other book has. So highly recommend it. Highly recommend it. It's a long ass book, but it's well worth it. I think it took me a month. It took me a month to listen to it, like every day after 2 hours a day.
See now, Jason, that's how you do a recommendation.
I'm becoming a grumpy old man. I don't like
you
anything.
You seriously are.
You know what though? Go listen to that book, and I tell you, you'll love it. And then you come back next week, and be like, you know what, Trisha? I'm hooked. I can't stop myself. But you know what? You
should the same recommendation.
I know you should have known though. Never go see sequels. Big Fat Greek Wedding. I saw that and I saw the ads. And then I
Matrix Reloaded I thought was better than the first. Let's go back to
what?
Yeah. Well, it
oh
had
no.
You know what?
Matrix, it had interesting. It had more interesting ideas. Visuals. That's yeah. it.
You know what
no,
it is?
I thought the story was better.
Ooh, I would take 2. I would take 2 and 3 and smash them together into a great sequel.
I would take 2 and 3 and smash them together and then throw it out in the trash. That's what I would do.
I thought 3 was awful. I thought 3 was awful.
3 was
I thought
awful.
2 was...
2 was great. Well, isn't 2 the one that introduced the guy in the machine?
The
suited guy. You know, the suited guy that Keanu Reeves encounters at the very end. I love that's a great character.
Yeah. Whatever.
Agreed. Agreed. I agree. His,
the architect, right? That's who it is? Yeah.
I do.
The architect. That's right.
I'm bursting to tell you guys about Batman vs. Superman, so let me just tell you about it really quickly.
Okay.
Yeah, say it.
Right after you watch it, you're like, oh, it's not as bad as people said. But then once you start thinking about it, you realize that no one in the movie had any motivation whatsoever. I will say this, though. The winner of that movie, Wonder Woman, Wonder Woman shows up, I damn well near fell to the floor and like rolled around, eyes rolling in the back of my head. It was incredible. The other winner of that movie, Ben Affleck as Batman. You know what?
And you're digging from the bottom of the
barrel.
People
generally.
Wait, why did you say ugh?
People generally don't like Ben Affleck. People just don't like him. But I'll tell you this much.
I don't understand. Why not?
Oh, we don't have time to get into that.
He's a very good actor and director.
But the point is that like of all the Batmans that's ever been on screen, his Batman was the most Batman-esque. Like the fight screen. You haven't seen.
How could he be?
Because when you watch the fight scenes that they choreographed, for the first time I felt like I was watching Batman on screen. That's what it looks like. That's how Batman fights crime. Now, he also killed a bunch of people, which
Batman doesn't do.
Which Batman doesn't kill. Extremely confusing. Yeah. But the fight scenes were so well done. He had the best scenes of the movie. The rest of it was, I'm sorry, it was garbage. And sorry, Warner Brothers, they are going to have to figure out what to do with the other 7 movies they said they were going to do on this premise. Whoops.
But you know what, though? They don't have to. No, don't you find that movies like that are impervious to reviews? I mean, the cash is already in your hand.
The thing is that this did so bad between week 1 and week 2, it dropped off 64%.
I never know how to judge those things because I'm always like, oh, God, this fans are just going on and on about it. And even if they hate it, they talk about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but this one was – listen, you both know that I am a huge DC Comics fan. I went to go see the movie because I felt like I had to because I've spent the better part of over 3 decades doing exactly this sort of thing. I wanted to like the movie so hard, but it's not possible to like it.
That's a great review right there.
If there is anybody you know
so hard.
If there's anyone you know who wanted to give this movie a good review, it's me.
It's you.
I could. I really wish I could. But okay. Wow. So yeah, so let's end on that note, guys. As always, it's been fun.
All right. Have a great night.
I mean, it was. I was still thinking about your. I was thinking about how horrible that review was.
No, it was so bad.
I don't understand the Ben Affleck thing. I don't get it.
Sometimes I tell you. Sometimes you know you see a movie that's so bad, and you're like, oh my God, this movie was so bad. You have to see it.
Yeah.
This is not one of those movies. I love you both. I respect your time. And I don't think you should see the movie.
That's appreciated. I promise I won't. I promise.
Okay, guys, on that note, we're done. Have a great night.
All right.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye.